Good evening, you guys. I'm Kilowatt 2, Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Kilo 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. His name is Mel. Mel and Dick, Dick and Mel, attempt to coordinate and lead this group of happy ham radio operators that gather most Sunday evenings over the last 29 years almost, 28 and a half years, and discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and the zillions of things that are connected to it. That includes transmitters, receivers, and antennas, and propagation, and all the 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. Lots to be learned about wireless techniques. The schools do a fairly poor job of teaching that. You really want to know somebody who understands wireless, you hire a ham radio operator. Be amazed how many people have that opinion. Let me drop. We make a sincere effort that during the first hour for the people who sign in at the beginning of the technical net, we try very hard to make sure they get at least a brief answer to their question. At the end of the first hour, Mel goes to the mailbag where he has received requests from people usually who don't have their ham radio license yet, guys who have discovered this on their scanner or by word of mouth, and they realize that these people are having a lot of fun, they want to join it, and they're in the process of getting their ham radio license, and they've got questions. So they go to the top of our priority list. After that, Paul tells us what's going on in space, WS2N, our space expert, what NASA's been doing. And at the end of that, after approximately 2 hours, we get into the deeper material. Let me drop. And it's been well known that not everybody appreciates the deeper material. It is the opinion of Mel and Dick that inside of every true ham radio operator, there's a kind of a scientist that would like to get out. And that scientist is curious about anything. Real progress that mankind makes is almost always because of curiosity. So when you see somebody who's curious, even if it's obnoxious to you at times, try not to squelch that curiosity. That's where real progress is taking place. So we dig into the deeper materials, and we know that that doesn't please everybody. And there are people who wish we wouldn't discuss those subjects. However, you know ahead of time it's going to happen. To be forewarned is to be forearmed. If that kind of material displeases you, then you don't want to be listening between 10 o'clock and 12 o'clock. There are 800 channels to your 2-meter radio, your synthesized 2-meter radio. You have the ability to listen to one of those other channels. There are people who think they're going to control what's being said. Let me drop. There are people who dislike that kind of material. They think they're going to control what's being said. And they think being disruptive is a method of doing that. And it's really not. A disruptive person, for the most part, is one who has realized other people are having fun doing what they're doing. They're not having fun for whatever reason. And if they think they can be anonymous and disruptive, they think they're going to get pleasure out of that. After a short period of time, they'll realize there is no pleasure in being disruptive, even if you're anonymous and you're getting away with it. You know, you don't really make any profit. You can't go on the air and brag about that as an accomplishment, if you know what I mean. So we shouldn't get mad at those people. For the most part, we ignore them. We go on. And to get mad at them and to recognize them is just to give them recognition, and they're going to continue. The jamming and disruptiveness is something that goes on in almost every state and almost every country where there are 2-meter radios. It's a sign of the times. And the fox hunting crews try to do something about that. It's not an easy problem to be solved. It's a problem that's got to be solved with the person realizing that there's more useful things they can be doing with their life. A person signs into the technical net by getting Mel and Dick, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, into MB, Barry, and yes. If you don't have a question or a comment, you just want us to know that you're there, you need not sign in. After 28 and a half years of TechNet, and this is TechNet number 1,362, by now we believe somebody is listening in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, where this repeater has a moderate amount of coverage. There's a lot of brain power in those three states, and we try to tap into that. We think we're running sort of a school here. For the most part, we believe people do become slightly educated, even though sometimes the subject is a little bit esoteric, but new material, when you first hear it, let me drop.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The whole learning process is to hear something you've never heard before, or certainly something you've never understood before. So the beginning of that process is always going to be uncomfortable. That's normal. So to feel uncomfortable when you're hearing brand new material is not unusual. Don't let that throw you. Just keep listening, and eventually some of the material will start making sense. That's the way we learn about anything. Start off, crawling, and then walking, and eventually running through that particular material. So give me your call letters right now if you've got a question or a comment for the net. KQRIW listening.
Who we owe, Dick?
Rich recognized. Anyone else? That was a very weak N2 something or other. Want to give that to me again? Okay, we're taking check-ins for the TechNet. So far we've got Rich, N2EO. Anyone else to check in for the TechNet with a question or a comment? Please give me your call letters and name right now, with the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment.
K2MU, Bernie, yes.
Okay, Bernie. And K2, is that Mike Uniform, Bernie?
That's right, K2 Mike Uniform.
We got you, Bernie. All right, so we got Rich and Bernie. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes. K2RIW.
WS2N, Paul. Yes, with a space report. Good evening, Dick.
Okay, you've got a space report, Paul. Will you have a question also? Should we put you on the list for questioners?
No, sitting here thinking, I know I had one early in the week, but that went out, right out of my head.
Okay, I'm going to put you down on the list with a question mark as a potential question, because it's going to occur to you when you hear these guys asking these great questions. Okay, so we've got Rich, Bernie, and Paul. Anyone else sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name and the word yes right now.
Yeah, good evening, K2KEY.
Okay, that mysterious voice was Mel. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now.
N2SDT, Nick, yes.
Okay, Nick, N2, it sounds like Sierra Victor Tango. Did I have that correct, Nick? Go ahead.
Affirmative, November 2, Sierra Victor Tango.
We got you, Nick. One last call. Anyone else assigned into the TechNet with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters right now and your name.
KC2WGB, after Melda.
We got you. Okay. Some mysterious guy named John. Let's start off with Rich, N2EO. I think I know some of the things that are new in Whitestone these days. And I hear tell that you've got house guests. More than just jingles. Over to you, Rich, N2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, good evening, Dick. TechNet N2EO. Yeah, I sent you a long email, and I sent a copy to Mel, and my phone's ringing, but I'm not going to pick it up right now. I don't know if you want to comment, but I do have a question for you, Dick. Let me turn it back to you and see. Yeah, we got a house guest, all right? A real nice house guest. Yeah, Dick.
Yeah, I'm wondering, what is your question, though, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, Dick, I sent you some information about that band, and, it's an audio question. I hope you can take it, and also I know normally you don't take recommendations on products, so if the question is out of order, just let me know, but someone runs this band, Jeremy. I promised him today that I was going to get an early Christmas present, because he needs it now. Namely, a wireless microphone for a tenor baritone, not for recording, but for live performance. He's using a wired mic, I don't know what he's using, but he did say he would like a wireless mic. And I wonder if anybody has a recommendation, a wireless mic for tenor baritone, not for recording, but for live performance. We're talking now professional quality, Dick. This is not a garage band. They've got close to $100,000 invested in this band. If you got my email, they already released an album. So we're looking at a pretty expensive mic. Anybody have any ideas? N2EO.
I am guessing that the broadcast industry has been down this road where in a broadcast studio where there's live entertainment taking place, where your personality is like to reproduce their voice with high fidelity. And because the person needs portability as they're walking around the studio, it's a wireless mic. Yes, most of those are a small microphone that's held near the person's collar. It clips onto the shirt, and it's got a wire that goes to the transmitter and a battery that sits on their belt, which maybe is or isn't quite what you're looking for. Maybe you're looking for the completely self-contained, round kind of a microphone, which again is wireless. So among our broadcast engineers, I wonder if anyone has a recommendation for a brand name of a reasonably high quality, what do you call it now, tenor baritone type wireless microphone that's used by broadcast. Give me your call letters if you have information on that subject. K2RIW listening.
This is K6DPZ Richmond Hill. Sennheiser makes a very high quality broadcast wireless mic.
K2KEY.
Okay, I heard both Mel and Hal. Hal, you said Sennheiser is a brand name that you respect. Could you spell that for me? And the particular model that you like, what's a rough rule of thumb as to the number of dollars? You got it, Hal.
It's Sennheiser. They have a lot of different models. They're a German wireless mic, very high quality. I wouldn't suggest any specific models now, but I know when I was involved in broadcast, we used them quite a bit. And if you go on the Internet, look it up, I'm sure you'll find they go wide price range, but it's very high quality.
Very fine, Hal. Thank you for that suggestion. We'll pick up Mel next, and I think there was a third person that Hal doubled with. We'll find out that other person. Mel first, K2KEY. Go right ahead, Mel. What's your favorite brand of wireless mic?
Well, sure, SHURE has been around a lot of years, and I've used their product before. It's been some years since I installed the system, but I assume that's still around, but they seem to make a very rugged piece of equipment. I've seen it in a lot of auditoriums over.
Okay, that's a good suggestion, and I thank you, Mel. And was there a third person giving us a recommended brand name of wireless microphone, broadcast quality studio, if possible? Give me your call letters right now. Looks like all we've got right now, Rich, although we can sometimes people sign in after a half hour or an hour, so we could repose the question at a time. Good luck with that search, and let us know how it goes. N2EO, KJ. Was there another person giving us some info? I guess not. So N2EO, go right ahead, Rich. K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, very good. Well, you do repost the question. It wouldn't be in a broadcast studio. We're talking about on-stage, live performance singer, tenor baritone. So not the studio. We're talking on-stage, live broadcast. I want to thank Hal for Sennheiser, S-E-N-H-O-U-S-E. Well, I will check that out. And it has to be a wireless mic, the way this person uses it, moves around a lot on the stage. So that it has to be high quality wireless. Okay, to go on to the next person, I thank you very much, Mel and Hal. K2RIW, Tech Net Weimark, and Suia.
Quick comment, Dick.
Okay, I heard John, and I heard a second person. We'll pick up John first, and then that other person. KC2WGB, I think that was you, John. Go ahead.
Yes, it was. A quick comment on that is he should speak to Eric. He's been involved in a lot of live production. He'd be able to give him an exact recommendation.
Okay, that's another good suggestion. Who is the other person with information on microphones? Give me your call letters right now.
Hey, good evening, WB2QGZ.
And William, you worked in broadcast, so what's your favorite brand of wireless microphone for a live personality walking back and forth on a stage? And of course it's a microphone.
P2EJ.
And it's going to be Eric right after Bill. And Bill, of course the microphone you're going to recommend, even though the volume in the studio or in the audience is turned up real high, it guarantees no No feedback. Believe it or not, that has been done by frequency shifting. Over to you, Bill. WB2QGZ, KQRIW.
Hey, good evening. Haven't done RF audio in a little bit. However, what I did a load of it. The vast majority of what I used was Sony stuff. Now, originally, we were using 900 megahertz Sony equipment in what would be the STL band. Those have five. I don't even know if they're still around. Then there were a bunch of 800 megahertz Sonys or 700 megahertz Sonys, which are now in TV spectrum that had those are also obsolete based on the choice of frequencies. However, Sony did make a whole bunch of really nice frequency agile RF mics with a handful of different types of receivers, either a diversity receiver, which you know, takes care of multi-pass hits while you're banging around. A lot of RF mics will have diversity receivers, and that takes care of that multi-pass issue as you're walking around the facility or wherever you are. It takes out a lot of those momentary hits as you're moving. Sennheiser, I've used a bunch of Sennheisers. They work good. There's a whole load of them. I can't recommend a specific model because I haven't done it in a little bit. I believe it's Sennheiser, it's Sennheiser with two N's, if that helps point it. And Shure, I've used a handful of Shure stuff. The Shure stuff I've seen was definitely less expensive than the Sony's. And I was a little scared, I'm timing out. Seems to work okay. I think also you can find some Lectrosonics maybe. That's also generally a broadcast quality mic, and most people use those with good luck. But, you know, first-hand experience with Sennheisers and Sony's. Back to you.
Hey, out of curiosity, is Lectrosonics a domestic brand name? Okay, let's go over to Eric. KEQEJ, go right ahead, Eric. You've only worked in broadcast for 20 years. What's your recommendation for portable wireless microphones? You got it, Eric.
Yeah. Lectrosonics, you don't also was doing call estimates.
Yeah.
Find that individual not heavy microphones public and like distortion. The frequency hot Sony.
Lots of good information there, Eric. And as you went down that list of brand names, one of the brand names you said very rapidly, which was the tiny little microphone, sounded like you say Countryman. Why don't you spell that one out for us? And I'm curious whether or not that's a domestic product. Over to you, Eric.
Slowly. Flip them to your tire, flip them to your, not to flip them to your shirt, a lot of this.
Okay, good information. Eric,
thanks.
Say that again, Eric.
One thing, you mentioned not hearing feedback. Broadcast is you a audio guy. You got one audio guy who's doing audio, the other one is audio. Output that's fed.
Impressive. How sharp are those plots? And with this anti-feedback microphone, can skilled high-fidelity ear tell the difference between a flat microphone and a slotted microphone? Over to you, Eric.
Not the microphone, Jake. It is a box. Then, as offset, push you overdrive output. Hey.
Impressive. Wow. I am guessing that this technique gives you some number of decibels of anti-feedback, 10 or 15 or 20 dB. Turn up the volume high enough that everything's going to eventually feed back. So if I understand you correctly, the live feed for the public address system in the studio or in the audience of an auditorium, you use slotted function, and for the actual broadcast, you don't need it, so there flat audio is sent. I'm getting the impression that you, the audience, which is jumping up and down and responding to the music, a little bit of a shift in the quality of the person's voice, they might not notice it. What brand name is that box that does all that slotting work, and how many slots are there through the audio band? Does it hear every octave or every kilohertz? Over to you, Eric, K2EJ, K2RIW.
Deductible between lot down to.
And what's the advantage and disadvantages of each of those slot widths, Rich? I mean, Eric, how does one choose which one of those potential modes of operation? You got it, Eric.
What about the size?
So I think you're really talking about the echoing time or the damping time of the venue, the amount of volume of the venue, so how long it takes for the echo to come back. If I've got a long echo versus a short echo time, a very live room versus a very dead room, which one of those scenarios gives me the best advantage out of narrow slots versus wide slots? Over to you, Eric. Okay. So what I think you're saying is that if you're blasting with a whole lot of sound in a very large coliseum, but there is a true echo coming from the back wall, coming back to the microphone, going through a second time, would give an unpleasant characteristic to one listening to it. So if you delay the sound coming out of the loudspeakers versus the microphone, you make that all coincident, and although there's an echo, you don't hear it as an echo. Is that approximately what's going on, Eric? Go ahead.
Thank you. Hello.
Yeah, let me go to the next step here. Let's assume now, in order to have real good coverage of that audience, I've got some loudspeakers that are aimed at the audience that are on the stage, hopefully to the left and to the right of the personality. I've got some intermediate speakers midway down the hall or down the ceiling. And in the back of the hall, I've got another set of speakers, and I've carefully adjusted the volume of all those. But if I'm real smart with the way I set up my bucket brigade circuit, my shift register, so to speak, my delay line, my digital delay line, I can make it sound like a person shouts real loud on the stage. You would hear him some number of milliseconds delayed at the back of the room if there was no PA system. If I properly adjust the delay of the signal that's sent to the speakers in the back of the room, I can make the sound come out coincidentally. So now he's really hearing all the sounds, all the places, with the right timing, and he's hearing no time shift at all, and it sounds like he's right alongside of the stage, even though he's in the back of the room. Properly engineered, is all of what I just described somewhat possible, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW?
RIW, KE2. That is the goal. So, in real life, as opposed to medically, they actually have tiles on the ceiling type of production that's going on.
Just to
try to set up the entire off of the hall to output. So, there are bad spots. But for the most part, it works.
My guess is the person with the skill to properly align all of those time shifts, amplitudes, directions, dampening of the room, sound absorption, anechoic materials properly placed and whatever, a person who's skilled that art, my guess is that's a rather rare individual. I'm guessing that's an individual that's had 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship, 10 or 20 years of apprenticeship to do that. And I bet he can demand a pretty good salary. I bet there's not very many of those. Bunch of guesses on my part. Open you for comments on this one, Eric. Jay, K2RIW.
Well, the reality is it's like quite expensive. Not quite good. Somebody in it, and a friend takes them a long time to that point. It's different than a guy who does talent.
Here's a tough question for you, Eric. At that great big conference that was held in 1969 called Woodstock, of that technology present there? Over to you, Eric.
Guys, the best they could. Don't forget they were using two Marshall powers. Guy going, hello. Wasn't quite there yet. Springs, was in the box,
Yeah, whenever you try to build an acoustic delay circuit system and you don't have proper dampening, Biswell control, and whatever, you tend to get triple transit, quadruple, and triple transit, and both transits and so on. Out of curiosity, Eric, during the Woodstock event, where was Eric Spiegel located?
Black and white camera. I don't have the physical walking.
The equipment that you were using for recording, I guess it was recording equipment, was that a U-matic tape, broadcast-type U-matic tape, if that existed at that time in 69, about that? That was around the time when helical scan hadn't yet been invented. Transverse scan was just coming into its own. Maybe you were using a conventional reel-to-reel type tape recorder. What kind of equipment were you using to record that event, Eric? And how in the world did you survive that? By that I mean, wasn't that a whole lot of hot, dry, muggy days? By dry, I mean dry to the mouth, but very moist as far as the local atmosphere is concerned. Give us a few words as to what that event was like and how long did it take you to recover? KEQEJ, the man who was at Woodstock, KQRIW and the Tech Man.
Well, the Oracle scan had been invented time before that. I was actually working with Tech and White, who was one of the things to the drum.
Wow. When you say tape was stick to the drum, I think you're talking about the rotary drum, the helical scan drum. No good solution for that if there wasn't enough natural silicone lubrication on the tape itself. You said stick to the drum. Does that mean that if you stopped the machine, you couldn't start it again? Or does it mean that occasionally the machine would grind up the tape and you'd have to go through a recovery procedure? Give us a few words on that one, Eric. Sounds like a fun time.
WO2Z.
Exact center of the slot bar that had the actual head spin between the slots of the two cylinders. There was tape speed. Once you got the thing up and running and it talked to this, A, you actually had stopped. You may have had trouble getting it started. The process of getting it started, of course, eventually it was side of the tape.
Okay, I think the other person who signed in was Ian, O2Z. Go right ahead, Ian.
Good night. Just a quick question. I caught the conversation kind of midstream, but I was interested in a box which somehow relates to the kind of discussion you're having. I was interested in finding some electronic means of deading in a room for doing audio recording. Not sure if Eric had suggested. Not for a large auditorium, but just for possibly a small room.
There are sound-canceling earphones where you know there's a very specific point of reception, the eardrum, you know the distance of that eardrum and the electronics of the earphone itself, and there's a microphone on the outside, to take the sound that's normally going to propagate around the earphone and get into your ear versus what goes through the microphone and electronics, to sound cancel so that only the recorded program hits your eardrum and all the local noise is dampened by 20 dB because you're in a noisy airplane and you're a pilot, I can see that. To electronically dampen a very large hall that has natural echoes, without an infinite number of loudspeakers scattered around that hall, I'm not convinced that's possible. But maybe Eric's got some good words on this. So tell us though what you believe can be done with electronic dampening of a live room, Eric. And second of all, when you get around to it, the Philips material that you were using for recording, I presume you were recording for one of the networks, KEQEJ, KQRIW.
No, it is not. Then you actually put the guy who provided the facility. That particular stuff was on 5-0.
Well, there was a major theater movie made of it, but now Ian's original question, he wants to electronically dampen a room. I think that's a very difficult thing to do, to get rid of the echo of the room by electronic means without a very large number of carefully controlled loudspeakers. I think that is somewhat impossible, is my guess. Give information on that one, Eric. KJ, KQLIW.
On Dick, it was a small room, say a 10 by 20 room.
I'm guessing it's a kind of a PA system in a room. Let's just take both answers. He said it's a small room, a 10 by 12 room, which has got echoes, and doing a recording in the room, electronically dampen that. And if there was a PA system, a small theater, could you electronically dampen the echoes? Over to you, Eric.
Hi. Actual situation. Off the wall.
You've got it, Ian.
That's exactly correct. Recording in a room, just going, from microphone straight to like a digital media, because the room don't rise, and trying not to physically change the room at all, because it has other purposes. So just being able to go in with the equipment, make the recordings, and then leave, just to dim the liveness of the room. Just a spoken voice, just conversational, level. Two people sitting at a table. That's the thing, I don't have the model number. It's basically set up, non-electrolytic. Regular mics going into a preamp, going into a computer. I could give you the exact model numbers next week, but I don't have that information in front of me. But they're not electrolytic.
Guys, the trick here, price kind of like highly direct. What I do is you want to start here to know you had a sit. That is the best way. Here the reflections are. Second best thing is to bring to them where the hard reflections are. Hard wall. Did you ever look at housing rooms?
Hey, and could you give maybe any literature that would go over the process of using a peak noise generator? And, you know, determining how the reflections, where they're coming from, and you know, how to best remove them or identify them.
That's a process that they don't generally see. It's really quite simple. I make a lot of money. Source from, take a little sound from return to the sound room, doubt where you get that signal. That's the place that you want to put sound. Anyway, Sonex is foam rubber, like little cone rubber.
Yeah, just, Friday, I was in an anechoic chamber, a radio anechoic chamber, which has these pyramid-shaped spikes coming out of the wall. And you stand in the middle of that chamber. My goodness, is that quiet. So RF anechoic material and acoustic anechoic material seem to have a fairly strong similarity. Okay, we're going to have to move on. Fascinating subject. Look what you've got us on there, Rich. I'm going to go to the next person to make sure we don't exceed our promise for the first hour. And we can always come back to the subject later. Bernie was the next person, K2 Mike Uniform. What would you like to talk about tonight, Bernie? K2RIW, the tech net. My name is Dick.
Hi, Dick. Hope you're talking to me okay. If there's any questions. When it comes to ground, I'm just, you know, rounding electrically and grounding it for RF. Whereas, if, for example, the signal, that is not the same. If I clarify that a little bit.
Quite good, Bernie. A little bit of hiss in the background, but you were coming through very clearly with that handy talkie near the window. The word ground is mildly controversial and slightly misunderstood by almost every amateur. Three main reasons ground. Number one would be electrical protection. In other words, if there is a third wire on the plug that goes on the wall, which is called the neutral or the safety, and it's to the chassis of your rig, and no, there may be a error that occurs in the hot side of the 110-volt line, touches the chassis, and the chassis became hot. Your hand on chassis, you are touching empty coax cable, and your other hand is touching a grounded object like a sink or a radiator. That would be a dangerous condition of electrocution. So the third wire for grounding your electronics, for electronic safety, and a ground fault interrupter, that's primary reason number one. Reason number two for grounding is lightning protection. You like to be, unless you've got a very well-grounded tower where your antenna is mounted on the side of the tower and the tower supplies the lightning protection, in some circumstances your antenna is the highest piece of metal in the neighborhood, and for the small probability, lightning might strike it, and you'd like to create a nice low impedance lightning strike to hit ground without going into the house, damaging the electronics, and catching the house on fire. So lightning grounding is another whole issue. When it comes to RF grounding, this is the one that's really misunderstood. Let's drop. There's a zillion people out there who believe that if they establish a better ground, all television interference will disappear, and all effects of standing wave ratio will disappear. Dead wrong. Nicest kind of an antenna in the world is a thoroughly balanced antenna, like a half-wave dipole fed with a 72-ohm twin lead. It's a thoroughly balanced antenna, thoroughly balanced transmission line with the right kind of a feeding device at the shaft to feed the twin. No grounding of any kind is required radio-wise in that situation. Any kind of grounding you would supply radio-wise would make no improvement. On the first half cycle, what that situation I just described would be doing is it would be gathering some of the charge from the left-hand side of the dipole and shoving it over to the right-hand side. Call an electron. It's gathering electrons from the upside side and shoving them over to the right-hand side. On the second half cycle, 180 degrees later, it's doing the opposite. Gathering electrons from the right side and shoving them into the left side. So the transmitter and transmission line is a kind of pump, pumping electrons back and forth in the antenna, and that creates the radiation I desire. Thoroughly balanced antenna. That's beautiful. No grounding of any kind is required. Now you go to the kind of an antenna that's unbalanced. Let me drop. Like a quarter wave vertical ground plane antenna. In the case of that dipole, I could have, if I wanted to, put a sheet of metal down the center of the dipole at right angles. So that would be a kind of a mirror where Because there is a neutral point halfway between the left side and the right side of the dipole, the sheet of metal there makes no change in pattern, the front-to-back ratio, the side lobes, the gain, whatever. Nothing changes. Once I've got that sheet of metal on a thoroughly balanced dipole, I could, if I want to, decide to feed the right-hand side of the dipole with reference to the sheet of metal, take the left-hand side of the dipole, throw it away, and say, hey, it's there as a mirror image in metal. And then I take this horizontal dipole with the sheet of metal, I rotate the whole thing 90 degrees, and I lay the sheet of metal on the ground. I've now got a quarter wave vertical ground plane. In that particular case, I'm now gathering the electrons from the sheet of metal, so to speak, and shoving them into the antenna, and then back again on the other half cycle. Now the word ground has significant meaning. Can we drop? Because in the real world, you and I are not likely to use an infinite sheet of metal. We're going to use a bunch of quarter wavelength long ground plane radials. Now, we call that ground, we call that radial, and now you want to put down enough of those so that the radio wave thinks it's a sheet of metal. In other words, wavelength-wise, there's a small enough spacing between each of the ground plane radials that the RF energy does not see the Earth. Because Earth, dirt, in your backyard is a volumetric resistive material, and RF energy that gets into that dirt is going to be turned into heat, and it's going to be wasted. So putting down enough ground plane radios is one solution to that problem. Taking the whole antenna and raising that ground plane antenna above the ground so that now it's got a lot of spacing with Mother Earth, all of a sudden on a station master-like antenna, so that the three little radios coming out of the bottom of that antenna are more than enough. Their whole purpose in life is to make sure that none of the RF energy goes up traveling down the outside of the coax cable. By the right kind of a balancing device used there, and or those three little radios if you have an elevated antenna. The thing works very well. So grounding, and now the next step of grounding, let me drop. If I happen to be on the 13th floor of an apartment building, now I'm feeding my antenna with reference to the metal frame of the building. Because that's my ground plane radios, and I don't want to put up all those radios. I'm putting this antenna out the, the veranda or the balcony of my apartment is where I'm doing all this work. In that particular case, grounding to that railing or to the metal of the building could be something you want to experiment with. By making the antenna, the radiator section, a half wavelength electronically, by making it a helical resonator, and making it literally, shrink the size, or literally making it a half wavelength long, you're now feeding the end of the dipole instead of the center. And although it's a little bit more difficult impedance-wise to do that, there's a huge advantage of doing that. In that particular case, if I make the antenna that's the radiator on this balcony of my apartment, I make it a half wavelength long electronically, I can now use nothing more than the metal railing that's below it to support as the grounding structure, because I'm feeding 1,000 ohm impedance because I'm outside of the dipole, the halfway dipole, and not feeding the center. That could be very adequate. That would be an adequate RF ground in that situation. You've only heard a little bit of the story, but maybe you've got enough of the data to, in future weeks, ask some more questions and do some more reading, and I hope that helps, Bernie.
Come in.
Hello, too. Mike Uniform to take it, KQRIW in the tech net.
Before I go on, do you still hear me okay now? Go ahead.
You're a little bit noisy, but we're hearing you. Go right ahead, Bernie.
Okay, I got to figure out the exact spot to the apartment here. But thank you for that in-depth explanation. Yes, it's been very, I haven't been able to wrap my mind around, and you've helped with that as far as ground idea. One follow-up question on that, and I'll leave. But just a follow-up question on that. Why is it when I hook up my ground on the outlet out of the apartment that the low-band signal come up? Is that because ground, we have ground wave, propagation? And
come to the first one.
Yeah, when it comes to adding an extra ground to, say, for instance, a simple 80-meter antenna, your S-meter becomes a louder signal. Your complete RF circuit, you're getting a better impedance match, and you get a greater S-meter deflection. Because of the greater S-meter deflection, because the signal on reception is stronger, quite possibly so. It would suggest that this inadequate ground plane radial system gets that kind of improvement. Just doing pure reception, let me drop. Just doing pure reception, believe it or not, a greater S-meter deflection may not be significant. On the 80-meter band, for instance, the amount of noise Mother Nature supplies from the ionosphere, from the atmosphere, from all those thousands and thousands of thunderstorms that are going on somewhere in the on planet Earth, and all that noise is coming to you. Because you've made some kind of a change in the antenna such that the signal is stronger, it turns out the noise is stronger also, and the signal-to-noise ratio probably didn't change on reception. But on transmission, it is telling you something. The fact that you air to ground and the signal strength goes louder does suggest that there's not enough for our ground plane radios on that particular lower frequency antenna. As you go to the higher bands, those ground plane radios that you've got on that antenna are now adequate, is a guess. Wesley wants to add a comment here. Into XJN, keep it a little bit brief. K2RIW, go ahead, Wesley.
Into XJN. MFJ makes artificial ground, so it is worthy of work just to take a dip. But the assumption of mine is that any kind of electronic ground will be decreasing the efficiency, and I would like to comment on that.
Yeah, if I was located on the 13th floor of an apartment building, for some reason I really fell in love with a quarter wave ground plane antenna, trying to establish a real good local ground. And if I wasn't smart enough to make the antenna a half wave resonator instead of a quarter wave, huge advantage to making it a half wave resonator. And that's one of the antennas that really hasn't been given anywhere near the emphasis it deserves. Half wave vertical antenna alongside of a tree or a building tower, fed from the bottom, fed from the outside end. There's a lot of advantage of that particular kind of antenna. Once you get around the problem of the fact that you're feeding 1,000-ohm impedance instead of a 70-ohm impedance. But on that 13th floor, I've got this quarter-wave antenna, and I want to create a local ground, and I'm not willing to put down the 30 individual radiators, round-plane radioles, on my balcony of my apartment, and I buy this thing called MFJ artificial ground. All it really is a circuit which has a piece of wire come from the shielded portion of my antenna. That piece of wire goes straight down to Mother Earth, and if I can force that piece of wire to be an even number of half wavelengths long electronically, I now reflect the ground of the Earth at the bottom of the building up to the point where I am. That's one way of looking at it. And yes, that piece of wire between the balcony and the Earth on floor number one, or below floor number one, that piece of wire will have RF current on it, and it will be part of the antenna, and it will be contributing to your radiation pattern. But as far as your quarter wave radiator on the balcony is concerned, now has a local ground that it's happy with, and you might get an increase in signal strength report on your S-meter. You will get an increase in performance on the S-meter of your receiver by using that artificial ground. Is that artificial ground a wasteful circuit? I think the answer is no. If the manufacturer of MFJ has done a good job at using moderately good quality components inside of that artificial ground, it's really an inductor capacitor network built with proper integrity. You're running a kilowatt of power, and that circuit could run ice cold. Yes, it is launching some current in that wire that goes from your balcony down to Mother Earth, but that's not necessarily bad. It's doing some of the radiating you desire in the first place. So would you call that loss? I don't think so. If that piece of wire is radiating a signal into space, just like the rest of the antenna above the balcony is radiating a signal into space, that could be a lossless environment. You could really prove whether or not it's lossy if you run 100 watts into it for 10 solid minutes. Maybe 1 minute would be enough, or 2 minutes would be enough. Turn off the transmitter, open up the box, touch everything inside, and see if everything's hot. If everything in the box runs ice cold, because it's a pure inductor or a pure capacitor, then by definition it has no loss mechanism. So it could give you an advantage in some circumstances. I know that that's not a completely clear... Let me go back to Bernie on this one. I know this is not a completely clear issue on this one, Bernie. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. K2 Mike Uniform, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2MU. Now, as I said, I bring up because it's something I just said.
confusing as far as what the term means for the bearing.
It's very interesting stuff, and it's been a ham a long time, and I do know that a little nuance like making sure you have a good ground is a big difference, and other times not make much of a difference at all. And I'm talking about electrical ground there. Okay.
Wesley's in for right, tell him to stop it, Jacob.
Back to you.
Yeah, you should know, Bernie, that when you move around, as you are now moving, you go from good spots to bad spots. And a little bit of what you said that time got dropped out. Know also that when you move around the room with a handy-talkie and you find the strongest signal for reception, it is not necessarily the best position for the strongest signal on transmission, because you're transmitting 600 kc lower than you're receiving. So the hot spots and the cold spots are different places for the transmit frequency and the receive frequency when you're on a repeater. Let me drop for a second. So now the best thing I could recommend is that if you had a second handy talkie and you can place it far enough away from you across the room and place it in a spot where it receives the repeater very loudly, but yet it's far enough away that it doesn't get jammed by your transmitter. And you take the first handy talkie, and while you're transmitting, you walk around the room just by transmitting a silent signal, and listen to the second handy talkie, and listen to the place where you hear the least amount of noise coming through the repeater. By that process, or by using somebody over a telephone, you'll eventually find out where are the best places for you to transmit from for a strong signal to the repeater. They're not necessarily the same position as for reception because of the differences in the frequencies. Now, I know that Wesley had another question on this one, so go ahead, Wes. N2XJN, K2RIW.
Okay, N2XJN. The manufacturer spec of MFJ states that the wire could be random at a certain length, not connected to the earth, not necessarily connected to the earth. My question is, if we have a roll of wire, how then this work, and what about the efficiency of the overall structure?
Yeah, when it comes to an artificial ground or an antenna tuner, impedance matching devices which have strong similarity to each other, if I have enough tuning range on my tuning networks, plural, meaning artificial ground and or antenna tuner, I then can take any piece of wire in the world, more than a few inches long, and maybe less than a few miles long, and anything in between. I can make it a perfect 50 ohm impedance match at my favorite frequency into my transceiver. That's the magic of electronic tuning. There is no magic length for an antenna if you have enough electronic tuning capability, because the way every antenna works with 98% probability is what we use, standing wave structures. That means I'm not talking about a rhombic or a beverage antenna, these antennas that are six wavelengths long. Among the antennas that are a small number of wavelengths long, a standing wave structure, the rule of thumb is you resonate first, then you radiate. And there is essentially no exception to that. If you want reasonable amount of efficiency on transmission, whatever is your radiating structure, you will resonate it at that frequency. Your electronic tuning gives you the resonance. Once you've got resonance, you've got the voltage buildup, you've got the current buildup, you have the ability to do the radiating, and you may not like the pattern you're going to get because of the way you have physically laid out that radiating wire, but that's another whole issue that you can model on a computer, if you know what I mean. So you can get 100% efficiency on 80 meters, for instance, out of a dipole-like antenna, which is 10 feet long instead of 132 feet long, the full length for a half wavelength. A 10-foot dipole on 80 meters, in theory, is only a half a dB less efficient in gain.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
I'm going to reword that. I've got a full half wavelength dipole, 132 feet long of wire, and I've got it 100 feet in the air. And step by step, I start cutting off that wire from 132 feet all the way down to 10 feet. and I keep retuning my antenna tuner, and I've got a low loss feed line. If I did that experiment, everybody you ask that question to will say, well, you're going to go way down in effective capture area, you're going to go way down in efficiency for reception or transmission. It's going to be a terrible antenna. Absolutely not. You read the appropriate chapter of the good antenna book by antennas by Kraus, 1950 McGraw-Hill, or the Antenna Engineering Handbook. The infinitesimal dipole fed with a lossless impedance matching network will not lose more than a half a dB of gain, and the gain is not really loss. You just broaden the pattern a little bit. So there is no magic length if you've got enough electronic tuning. Not many people know that. It's a well-kept secret. Over to you for a comment on that one, Wes. That's, I think, the nature of the question you're asking. N2XJN, KQRIW in the...
It narrows.
Yeah, actually, that was the nature of my question. Thank you very much. Go to the next question. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on, Bernie. And, Bernie, you're allowed to come back with more of those questions because although we gave you a lot of information, believe it or not, it's only a fraction of the story. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye. The last person was N2SVT, so Sierra Victor Tango. Nick, go right ahead, Nick, K2RIW.
Dick, thank you very much, N2SVT. My apologies if this question's been asked before, but it's slightly related to what you guys were talking about. My superintendent has been very gracious in allowing me to install one dipole on the roof of a wood-structured pre-war building, six stories high, the northern tip of Manhattan. My question is, and I've researched this in the AWRL handbook and antenna book, and I wasn't able to find a decent answer, how much higher above the roof should that antenna be when most antenna books talk about the height of a dipole above ground? Can the antenna be 5 feet above the roof of a wood structure building, or must I go, or do I consider the roof of the building ground now?
Yeah, don't worry, Nick. You got a good question, and there's no simple answer to this one, but I'm going to give you a bunch of opinions. If it's truly a wooden building with real tar paper and tar shingles and no sheet metal anywhere underneath it, then whether assume the building, I'm going to pick a number out of the air, assume the building is three stories high, so therefore you're 30 feet off of the street level with your antenna. And you're now talking about, would there be a difference in performance if the antenna was 5 feet off the wooden roof or 20 feet off the wooden roof? In theory, there would be very little difference. There's a couple of catches. Even though the majority of the building is wood, there may be some sheet metal under what you think are the shingles, particularly if it's a flat roof. There may be a copper roof underneath the tar. On top of that, although it's a much smaller perturbation to the antenna, in other words, the structure I'm not talking about, if you had X-ray vision and you looked at that building, let me drop. You've got X-ray eyes that work at radio frequencies, and you look at that building, you're going to see metal downspout tubing for the rain gutters. You're going to see the rain gutters. You're going to see the conduit tubing that has the 110-volt wiring. You're going to see...
Tell him not to worry about.
You're going to see the plumbing. You're also going to see the vent pipe for the sewage system that goes up to the roof. There's all kinds of metallic structures in that building. With rare exception, the majority of those metallic structures have a very minor perturbation on your antenna radiating characteristics, as long as those structures just don't happen to be a resonant length at your frequency, which is a fairly rare situation. But there's one other catch, and that is the wiring of the building. If your antenna is very close to that wiring, you're going to be putting quite a bit of RF energy into the wiring, and there is a chance that your neighbors are going to get television interference, radio interference, telephone interference, and so on, because you're lighting up the whole building with RF energy. Every extra foot you put between you and the wiring and the neighbor's antenna for his television set and whatever is going to be helpful. So there's a bunch of variables involved. Nothing's going to explode. It's not going to catch on fire if you get it wrong the first time, and if later on you've got to go back and raise it a little bit to increase the amount of spacing between your antenna and the metallic structures of the building. Give it a try. Start off at the 10-watt or the 100-watt level. Don't radiate a kilowatt right away until you find out how well your equipment works in your apartment. If your television set is being jammed and your radio and your telephone is being jammed, then start working on that even before asking the neighbors whether or not they're getting interference, if you know what I mean. Back to you, Nick. N2 Sierra Victor Tango, K2RIW. My name is Dick.
Dick, thank you very much for the explanation. The majority of the building is wired for cable TV, if not all of it. And I don't plan to run anything more than 100 watts. Your explanation for RFI and the telephone interference, would that still apply if I'm only transmitting at 100 watts power level?
The answer should be no, but quite often it is not, Nick. What happens is that sometimes the wiring of the cable TV system has interruptions in the shield because somebody didn't do a good job of putting the connectors on it. And so even though they're losing 15 dB of signal because they've got a poor connector, they don't realize that the system is not well shielded. It's actually open to the environment, so to speak. And a 10-watt transmitter could jam that television, that cable TV system, if the antenna was close enough to it. If it's a well-shielded system, properly installed, you could probably run a kilowatt with no problem. So slowly sneak up on the power until you find out what does work and what doesn't work. There are some brands of wired telephone that are made with an inexpensive plastic package with no shielding and very little bypassing on the RF bypassing of the wiring to that telephone. There are some brands of inexpensive a wired telephone that can pick up radio signals like you wouldn't believe. And when that happens, in some cases, what the amateur has done is to realize, that it's one particular neighbor with a real inexpensive telephone. And you can go through the process of trying to talk the neighbor out of the interference, so to speak, ask them, and by the way, try to be compliant. In other words, when a neighbor complains, don't tell them it's their problem, even though it really is. It really is your problem because we all live in each other's backyard, if you know what I mean. You got to stay friendly with the neighbors or life's going to get very complicated real soon. You could start off in the beginning saying, what's your favorite television watching hours, and I won't go on during that time until we solve the problem, until we put on the right kind of a filter. In the case of a telephone, you can't control what hours the person's going to get a phone call. And so, and modifying his telephone is not an easy process you want to get involved in. One or two amateurs I know could have either gone down the road with a lawsuit and complaining and shouting profanity at each other with the neighbor because of the telephone interference, or you simply go out and buy the person a better telephone and hand it to them and the problem goes away. You'd be amazed how many smart amateurs have done that. Not always the best solution, but at least consider it as a possibility. So the 100 watts you're going to run shouldn't create television interference. But there are times when things are not going so well in your building, and 10 watts can do it. So you'll have to play it by ear and come back and ask us more questions, if you know what I mean, Nick. N2SVT, K2RIW.
Dick, thank you very, very much for that explanation. One more quick note. I've been listening to you since I've been a teenager on and off, and thank you so much for being on every Sunday. N2SVT.
Okay. Hey, that's a testimonial from Nick, Mel. We have to send him a bill. That's a joke. Okay, at this time we go over to the mailbag a little bit later than we're supposed to be. And what kind of burning questions have you had this week? And you sound good, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW on the tech man.
Okay, good evening all again. This is K2KEY, thank you. Yeah, I was trying. It was quite a battle. Quite a hard, hard battle. But trying to really do our best under the circumstances. Okay, anyhow, I won't get into that because I don't think it's appropriate really to get into the nitty-gritty of this type of situation with the tech demo. All right, I'm just looking through some things here. I think this one is pretty good. Oh, I have to be an old-timer. Let's try an old-timer for a change. And I have a problem of hearing. My hearing is such as that I have to use what is called a DTC hearing aid that's two behind the ear. Let's see. They don't provide really great telephone or television usage. But do you know something that I can use for amateur radio to improve this? Go ahead.
When it comes to the so-called HAC requirement, hearing aid certification or something like that. In other words, cell phones, there are a number of brands of cell phones. which intentionally put out a certain amount of local magnetic fields as well as the audio. And if that local magnetic field is made right at the earpiece, and if you buy the appropriate hearing aid, which is properly designed for that, you are now coupling the energy out of the cell phone magnetically into the pickup loop that's in the hearing aid, and you get nice